This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll get an update on lawmakers discussing a hike in Illinois' gas tax. The additional money could help fund infrastructure needs, but drivers would pay a higher cost at the pump. What's the right age for kids to be left home alone? There's legislation that would lower the age, and it's moving at the State House. Devastating events in our lives can be emotionally shattering, but an author and cancer survivor says it's important to find perspective.
You know, we hear of post-traumatic stress, and that is absolutely a real thing that happens to a lot of people, but it's almost equally, if not more common, for people to experience this concept of post-traumatic growth.
And we'll learn about lifelong learning programs and meet a group of senior scholars. It's all ahead this hour on Statewide. Thanks for tuning in for another edition of Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, finding perspective in the face of adversity. We'll talk with a woman who has walked the walk. Well over two decades ago, Illinois adopted a parental notification law when it comes to minors seeking an abortion. Some are now saying it's time to do away with that rule. We'll hear from both sides. And at what age should children be allowed to stay home alone? You may have your own answer, but the state requires them to be 14 years old. There is a push to lower it. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. First up this week, there are now two proposals on the table for a state public works program. We continue to hear about infrastructure from roads and bridges to water and sewer projects, even buildings that are in need of repair. One of the proposals is from a construction union and was filed by the head of the Senate Transportation Committee, Senator Martin Sandoval. Another comes from the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, and our reporter Mary Hansen has been watching the issue. She joins us now. So, Mary, what is similar about those two proposals?
So, first, both proposals would raise the gas tax and some registration fees to pay for infrastructure improvements. They both only deal with funding and projects for what they call horizontal work, where the highways and bridges, rails, roads, that sort of thing. And the chamber's plan actually includes public transit as well. So the plans don't cover things like state buildings, so the prisons or the Capitol or things like that. And they wouldn't cover funding for, facilities at universities, at public universities or schools. So that part, these two plans would not cover.
Okay, so that's what's similar. What are the big differences?
So the big differences around sort of the nitty-gritty numbers. For example, the union's plan would double the gas tax, so raise it by 19 cents per gallon. And the chamber plan, sort of when all is said and done, they would have a 25-cent increase. But what they're asking for is to get rid of the state sales tax on gas. So there's an additional 6.25%, the standard statewide sales tax that you pay when you buy gas, in addition to the per gallon tax. So their plan would eliminate that.
We keep hearing about the need for a state infrastructure program. The last big one was quite a while back. And how did we pay for it at that time?
Yeah, so the last one was about a decade ago under Governor Pat Quinn. It was $31 billion. They called it the Illinois Jobs Now Act. And they paid for it with a combination of higher taxes on alcohol and liquor. They also put in some higher fees for driver's licenses and vehicle registration. And then the state also started video gambling at that time, which helped to pay for some of these improvements.
So have we heard anything about more of a hodgepodge of revenue sources to pay for this plan beyond just maybe a gas tax increase?
Yeah, I mean, both of these plans, the ones that are out there right now, would raise a couple of other fees. Lawmakers are still early in the process of negotiating this plan, so there could be other funding sources, other suggestions of ways to pay for it. In the past, there's been ideas thrown out like using some of the money for recreational marijuana or things like that, but no sort of concrete proposals yet.
Well, Governor J.B. Pritzker, he'll have a say in this when it's all said and done. Do we know where negotiations stand at this point?
Yeah, so J.B. Pritzker has said that he wants a plan done by the end of the session, and he has a sort of senior staff who's helping to work on this, working with lawmakers. The lawmakers are still hearing requests for money to be part of this bill. This past week, they heard from city and county governments and hospitals and other community groups. And then in the next couple of weeks, they'll be continuing to hear from that. There's a state transportation committee that's traveling around Illinois, sort of hearing from different stakeholders. Next week, they'll be in Peoria and then Chicago and then Elgin. So with a plan this large, this sort of, you know, that will require a lot more funding and sort of give out a lot of money, it could likely take until the end of session to sort of figure it all out.
And just about 2 months left until the scheduled adjournment of the legislative spring session. Mary Hansen is reporter for NPR Illinois. Mary, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Battling cancer three times and a brain aneurysm, that might be enough to wear down even the best of us. Courtney Clark has been there. She's an author and someone who teaches others how to persevere when life doesn't always go your way. She'll be speaking in Springfield next week at a fundraising event for the Simmons Cancer Institute. I had a chance to talk with her in advance. Courtney, you've had a lot of challenges to overcome. I read where you called yourself the luckiest unlucky person in the world. You seem so optimistic. Was that always the case?
Well, to be fair, I have always been a person who's had an easier time seeing the possibilities and the bright side. But at the same time, when you go through challenge after challenge, there is a sense of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And that can make you become pessimistic. For me, it was on the heels of my first two cancer diagnoses, then getting the diagnosis of a brain aneurysm, completely unrelated to the cancer. And when you get through, it's this competing feeling of, are you kidding me? Haven't I been through enough? This is so unfair. You know, the question we all ask ourselves, why do these things happen to me? But then realizing, my gosh, if I hadn't had the cancer, I never would have had the scan that led the doctors to find this brain aneurysm. So it's this weird competition between certainly the things that have happened to me, these health challenges in particular, pretty unlucky. But you can also shift your perspective and realize, dang, it turns out to kind of be lucky after all. And in facing that and going through times when I didn't feel lucky, I didn't feel happy, realizing that like most things in life, you can perceive something as, oh, this is horrible, this is the worst. And then you can look at it from another angle and go, well, maybe actually this will turn out to be good.
A person, I would think, is entitled to a little self-pity when you face such challenges as cancer or a brain aneurysm or maybe something else that's going on in a person's life.
Absolutely. I would be lying if I pretended like I didn't have some self-pity. In fact, with the brain aneurysm, my recovery, Sean, was so hard, very painful, grueling, long. It just made me feel so helpless because here I was an adult. I was a newlywed and I couldn't take myself to the bathroom. And you feel so powerless that there were some moments when I just wished that I could give up. And I knew how badly that would hurt my family, my brand new husband. And so I embrace that and I talk about it because I do feel like we sometimes look at people who have overcome big health challenges and we look at them as heroes and, oh my gosh, they're so strong and, oh, how did they get through? And I do think it's okay to talk about the challenges and the self-pity, as you say, because if we don't talk about that, then it looks like everybody else is really strong. And then if it's us going through it, we might think, oh, I must really be a weak person because I want to give up. I'm having a bad day. And then the challenge is to not stay there.
You mentioned friends and family, and I've been in that situation knowing people who have gone through certain health scares and other problems that they're facing. And it's a tough situation to be the person on the outside. You always, of course, want to tell somebody to look on the bright side. But at the same time, that's easy for me to say. And so do you have advice for people who know people who are going through some of these things?
I do. It's actually one of the more common questions that I get asked is, how do I help this other person in my life? How do I help somebody else get perspective? One of the reasons it's such a struggle is that perspective, I mean, just even look at the word, it's so personal. And you can't really give somebody else perspective. And we know that because we all kind of bristle whenever you hear the words like, well, at least it's not blah, blah, blah. You know, that often isn't helpful to people who are grieving or going through something difficult. This realization, well, yeah, I mean, it could be worse, but come on. What I have found is helpful is you can't give someone perspective, but you can give them opportunities to get perspective. So for example, if you're a parent and you have a child or a teenager who, you know, didn't get something that they wanted and they feel like their life is over, can you take them to volunteer? And you then it'll be more helpful. I was having a conversation actually with a woman yesterday who was in one of my audiences, and she has a friend who lost a spouse. And what she really wants to tell this person is, but at least you got a chance to say goodbye. You know, at least you knew that this was going to happen and you got to live out his last months with him. I have these other friends and they lost their spouse in an accident and they didn't get to say goodbye. But really, you can't hear that from somebody whose spouse is still healthy and present. So in my opinion, then the best way for somebody like that to get perspective might be to go to a grief support group and have that realization on her own. Wow, this person didn't get to say goodbye to their spouse. What I went through was horrible, and I can also still be thankful that I got this one gift.
I'm talking with Courtney Clark. She is an author and cancer survivor ahead of her speaking engagement in Springfield next week. And Courtney, you've talked about perspective. That's what you bring to people through not only writing books, but also going out on a lot of speaking engagements.
Yes, I feel like I have the best job in the world because I get to help people. We all struggle, right? It's not always cancer. It's not always health related. I often go into businesses where they're facing change or people are under a lot of stress. And I not only share my story, but I also share research that I've done on how do we rise up to these challenges? What are the strategies that work best to help us manage the stress, the challenges, the chaos, the changes in our lives, and kind of let go of the expectation of what was going to happen? And then how do we continue to be successful moving forward when the world has shifted?
You talked about volunteering, being more involved when you're going through something like that. I know a lot of people who maybe through medication that they are on don't quite feel up to doing those types of things. Is it so much a standpoint that they have to, you know, get out and every single day get up and go do something? Or is it just, is there another way to approach that?
Absolutely. So, in fact, this was what my first book and what my graduate research was on that became the basis for my book, The Giving Prescription, was about how people who are, you know, healing from something, from a trauma, how they can use service and giving back to heal. And it doesn't always mean getting out of the house and volunteering hands-on. That's not always the right call for everybody, no matter where you are, you know, in your healing trajectory, because of personality differences, whatever it is. But there are ways that you can, the great thing that service gives you, that volunteerism gives you, is a feeling of what's called self-efficacy, right? That's the belief that you can impact the world, your own world, somebody else's world in some way. And through self-efficacy, we regain personal power and strong ego. And you don't have to leave your home, drive somewhere, and volunteer face-to-face with somebody to get those benefits of connecting with other people. It could just be participating in an online forum and providing help and support to somebody else. It's that simple.
I've often heard that, you know, it's the bad things in life, going through the bad times that help people grow, that help them sometimes come out on the other side of that with a much different outlook. That's what you're trying to get across, right?
It's exactly right. When I started doing this research, there's a concept called post-traumatic growth. You know, we hear of post-traumatic stress, and that is absolutely a real thing that happens to a lot of people, but it's almost equally, if not more common, for people to experience this concept of post-traumatic growth. And I think it's because of exactly what we talked about, the perspective. When you go through something different, you can't help but look at life in a different way. And I know that's true for me. I mean, so much of my life changed, my profession, my relationship, because like so many things we go through in life, anytime we go through any big experience, but especially when it's a traumatic experience, we reevaluate. Who am I? And you know, what am I going for in this world? And what's my place in this world? What's my purpose? I don't know that we ever fully answer the question, but it helps us refine our answer to the question about, hey, what am I here to do?
For someone who's received a curveball in life, or maybe some bad news that they're trying to deal with, what is the one thing you want to get across to them?
Connect to other people, but be really clear about what you're looking for in terms of support. Sometimes the people closest to you in life may not want you to be sad and suffer, so they may say things like, oh, it's not so bad, it's going to be okay, buck up. And you may need to search outside of your inner circle for someone who's been through something similar. So search high and low, lean on every avenue that you have for support, because when we connect to other people, that allows us to find perspective, to take in the information that we need to solve a complicated problem we may not have been up against before. So lean on other people, but be really aware that not everybody is going to be able to give you the advice that you seek.
And Courtney Clark will share her story and lessons learned at the upcoming Women's Power Lunch Against Cancer in Springfield. That's coming up next week. We have more details at our website, statewideshow.com. Stay with us on Statewide. Nurses want to see patient loads reduced. They say it will result in better care. We'll hear more about it. That's up next. We're back on Statewide. Ahead, we'll hear about a museum exhibit in Illinois examining the relationship between dogs and humans. We also hear how some people remain lifelong learners. Maybe you're one of them. That's on the way. Illinois lawmakers are being asked to decide whether nurses are dangerously overworked and what to do about it. Nurses want limits on how many patients they're assigned. They say it would improve patient outcomes and workplace safety. But opponents say a one-size-fits-all approach won't work. Dana Vollmer has more details.
Illinois nurses are pushing for legislation that would limit hospital nurses to 4 patients or less. That number would be lower in certain areas, like maternity wards, intensive care units, and emergency rooms. Doris Carroll is vice president of the Illinois Nurses Association. She told lawmakers about one nurse's experience working alone in the ER.
She had a waiting room full of 30 people. A woman was on the floor in a terrible abdominal pain. Next thing she saw was a man walking in through the door, an elderly man who's clutching his chest. So she made the decision because she felt that this man was critical and was having a heart attack. She was right. When she came back, that woman was dead.
Carol says the patient could have been saved if more nurses were present, but hospital administrators say it's not that simple. AJ Wilhelmy is with the Illinois Hospital Association.
There is no conclusive evidence that these one-size-fits-all nurse staffing ratios actually improve patient outcomes or the quality of care.
He says not every hospital has the same resources, and the legislation does not include funding to hire more nurses.
About 42% of our hospitals are currently operating at a negative or very thin margin of less than 2%.
Wilhelmy says the plan would drive up healthcare costs by more than $2 billion a year. He says it would be especially burdensome for safety net and critical access hospitals, like Touche Regional Hospital in Centerville. Sobrina Day is the CEO.
Touche is highly dependent upon the Medicaid program, which historically and currently has been a low and slow payer. Two-thirds of our patients are covered by Medicaid, and with the expansion of Medicaid managed care, our financial challenges have only worsened.
Day says her hospital is already expected to lose $1.4 million this year. She says adding another unfunded mandate could force them to cut services. Hospital administrators also say strict ratios would hamper their flexibility in assigning nurses where they're most needed. That could be made even more challenging by the nursing shortage. They say Illinois is expected to be down 21,000 nurses by next year. Marty Smith is with National Nurses United. She used to work as a nurse in California, the only state with mandated nurse-to-patient ratios.
Our experience in California shows that if you build it, they will come. The number of actively licensed RNs increased by more than 90,000, almost seven times more than the total number state health officials said would be needed to meet the ratios.
Advocates argued that safe patient ratios would help Illinois attract and keep more nurses by improving working conditions and preventing burnout. Alice Johnson is with the Illinois Nurses Association.
Not only do nurses face economic insecurity by the practice of low censusing, being sent home without pay and having to use their own benefit time, but they also face serious issues of workplace violence and also occupational injury.
Still, hospital administrators say they should continue to make staffing decisions. Current law requires hospitals to take recommendations from a staffing committee that's at least half nurses, but it doesn't require them to implement the plan as recommended. Under the legislation being considered, hospitals could be fined up to $25,000 for violating the proposed nurse-to-patient ratios. I'm Dana Vollmer.
Under an Illinois law that's been enforced for 5.5 years, minors must tell a parent or a judge before having an abortion. Right now, the General Assembly is wrangling with the possible repeal of what is called the Parental Notification of Abortion Act. And our Illinois Issues report this week focuses on that topic. Maureen McKinney reports.
Sometimes girls who are pregnant fear informing a parent that they want to have an abortion. Perhaps a parent has abused them physically or emotionally, or a young girl might think she'll be thrown out of the house or will disappoint her family.
What we have right now is a situation that puts young people at risk. Right now, we have a situation where if you are a young person and you have an unplanned pregnancy, you have the opportunity to be ostracized by your family, to be put in physical danger.
That's Democratic Senator L.G. Sims of Chicago, who is sponsoring a plan to do away with notification. In Illinois, while notification is required, parental approval is not. Attorney Peter Breen represents the conservative Thomas More Society, which is staunchly opposed to a repeal in Illinois.
It would turn Illinois into an underage abortion haven. Before our current parental notice law was in effect, we had thousands of young people getting abortions without the parents knowing, including many hundreds, if not thousands, coming from out of state.
Breen has argued the law has resulted in a drop in the number of underage abortions, but those who want to get rid of it say the drop is due to better access to contraception. Chicago attorney Melissa Wyden has represented on a volunteer basis more than 24 young people since the law started being enforced in 2013. Through that program, the ACLU has helped about 400 teens go before judges. Wyden said it is difficult enough for the teens to tell her the details, and the girls' humiliation is exacerbated when they go before a judge and a court reporter.
I represented one very frightened and desperate young woman who had a very difficult relationship with her mother, and she told me when I first met her, and then she told the court at her bypass hearing that when her mother got angry at her, she would say such hurtful things that the teen would cut herself afterwards.
Another of Wyden's clients was a 15-year-old
who had an abortion and went into a severe depression afterwards because her mother told her father, her sisters, her extended family. Her father stopped speaking to her. Her sisters ridiculed her. The rest of her family didn't speak to her, and she became suicidal. She did not know about the bypass option at the time. So there is real danger that teens experience.
but many believe the decision is too important for those under 18 to make on their own. Dawn Fitzpatrick, who works on anti-abortion programs with the Archdiocese of Chicago, says young people can be impulsive.
For a young person who might hear that they're going to disappoint their parents or that they just don't want to talk about it, it might seem easier to go ahead and get an abortion. They don't have to consult their parents. And then these poor children grow up to regret their decision. I had a woman call the other day who said to me, when I went to have this done, nobody told me how it could hurt me. They just said it was good for me. And she said, and I've been affected by it since 1974.
But Wyden, the attorney, disagrees.
Having seen firsthand up close the effects of this law on the lives and the health and the emotional well-being of many, many teens over the past 5 years, I can tell you that this law is dangerous. It is unnecessary. It does nothing to protect teens, and it causes great, great harm.
A committee has given approval to the repeal, but it still needs House and Senate okay before going to the governor's desk. I'm Maureen McKinney.
We have more about efforts that could get rid of Illinois' parental notification law, that story, at our website at statewideshow.com. The Pick Museum of Anthropology at Northern Illinois University is presenting an exhibit this spring examining the relationship between dogs and humans. Guy Stevens has the details.
The first thing you see when you enter For the Love of Humans, A History of Dogs, is a dog at a fire hydrant, a little humor to break the ice. But there's so much more to know about the connection between dogs and humans. So says the museum's acting director, Rochelle Wilson-Loring. She curated the exhibition.
We're actually exploring the way that humans and canines have co-evolved with each other for thousands of years. So we're looking a little bit at both, but we are focusing a little bit more on the canines.
A lot is packed into the relatively small space. Pictures, religious objects, a dog sled, complete with a team of huskies, not real ones, and lots of displays on the various topics, with plenty of text for those who want to do a deeper dive. Wilson-Loring says it starts with how the two species came together.
Humans and canines, wolves, really, have a very similar social structure. And so the origins of their relationship started as a very mutually beneficial relationship. They could hunt together and be more successful because they were hunting together.
Looking around at the exhibit, you see how dogs have woven themselves into our lives in many ways. In religion, for instance, dogs are represented in ancient Mexican votive pieces, and the Nepali version of the Hindu festival of Diwali devotes a day to celebrate dogs. They've helped not only with hunting, but transportation. Before the horse came to the New World, Native Americans used them to drag supplies from place to place. Today, they're shepherds and more. Have you ever heard of Swedish truffle dogs? Did you know they had truffles in Sweden? Loring Wilson says the country has become a market leader, something to do with the warming climate, she says. More generally, she says service dogs have become an integral part of society as guide dogs and police, fire, search, and rescue dogs, like Izzy, NIU's explosive ordnance detection dog.
She can actually sniff out 19,000 combinations of explosives. So she goes through our stadium beforehand to check and make sure things are okay. She goes through the buildings and checks to make sure everything is okay in the buildings as well. And she's even helped the DeKalb Police Department.
Not to mention therapy dogs, like those that come on campus at the end of the semester to help relieve the stress of finals. Utility is one thing, but it still doesn't explain the close bond between dogs and humans. Wilson-Loring says there are a lot of reasons given, love, loyalty, social hierarchy, but scientists are still not sure exactly what's behind it. They just know it goes way back. There are ancient dog remains that show signs of veterinary care, and there are examples from traditional societies.
Inuit communities have had very, very strong relationships with their canines as companions, not only in everyday working life, but in just general life, you know, as family members as well. So this concept of dogs as members of the family has been around for centuries.
Which hasn't protected them from abuse. Wilson-Loring says the exhibit looks at the rise of welfare societies. It also discusses puppy mills and the problems they can create. And then there's another issue that she says surprises a lot of visitors to the museum.
Usually there's around 60,000 dogs that are used for animal testing every year. And beagles are the number one animals that are used in animal testing facilities because they're generally very docile, they have large litters of puppies.
The exhibit includes examples of common products that do not use dogs or other animals for testing, On that score, she says, the exhibit is more than just about imparting information.
A part of our mission here at the PIC is to be a part of social justice dialogue and affecting change within our community. And so for this exhibit, we have our Support Local Animals wall.
There are even bins to put donations in. But whether they do that or not, she wants visitors to leave excited about what they've learned and the place of dogs in our lives and in our hearts. I'm Guy Stevens.
That exhibit titled For the Love of Humans, A History of Dogs runs at the PIC Museum of Anthropology at Northern Illinois University through May 10th. Lifelong learning programs offer people over the age of 50 the chance to tackle new topics long after they've earned their diplomas. Peter Medlin checked in on a group of these senior scholars at Waubonsie Community College.
At the Sugar Grove campus of Waubonsie, the halls overflow with fresh faces weaving between classes. But if you turn into one classroom on most Monday afternoons, you'll find a less traditional group. This class is called Knowledge Enrichment, and everyone in here is over 50 years old. Most are over 70. Knowledge Enrichment is part of the Lifelong Learning Institute, or LLI. Their Waubonsie branch is one of many at colleges across the country, including numerous other ones in Illinois. This class is being facilitated by Marjorie Logman. It's a smaller one than usual, only around a dozen students, but she says it'll be good since everyone will have a chance to have their voice heard.
Many of us are trying to change the view on aging.
Their chapter has been growing steadily in the past few years. Just this year, they added another 50 new members. They've got students in their early 50s and some hovering around 90.
LLI has almost 400 members, and the socialization is so needed today. We have banquets, we have coffee clutch, we have tours that we take.
Logman is 70 and has been a part of the group for about 4 years now. She got hooked initially after taking a class about Fox News and its impact on culture. The class today is more conversation than lecture. They'll tackle one topic per week for 2 hours, anything from the effects of climate change to the healthcare system. Two others in the class are Gail Tattersfield and Val Henrick. They've both been a part of LLI for more than a decade. In fact, Henrick has been taking classes close to 20 years. She's 75 and a retired teacher. She says she first found out about the program from a flyer she found at the library where she could take wildlife classes.
I thought, well, I'll check that out, and I did, and I've been with it ever since. That was about the year 2000.
Tattersfield is 78. She says the reason she stayed involved is not just the classes, but the community.
I mean, we have close to 400, and yet it feels like a family.
Some LLI programs are funded with large grants or endowments, which allow teachers to be paid. But in this case, a lot of people in the program choose to volunteer outside of their classes to keep the organization going. Some of them join the board, help send out mailers, or even decide to teach a class themselves, including Tattersfield.
But I ended up being on the curriculum council and on the board, and I facilitated class on writing your memoirs.
Val Henrick has done the same. She also facilitated classes, she did some wildlife courses, and even an art class. Henrick agrees it's those friendships that keep her coming back.
Many interesting people made good friends, and I'm impressed that they come from all around the whole Fox Valley area, that I don't have to confine myself to my neighborhood or my local church or wherever to build those relationships.
In fact, students and former students from that class are still making art and will have their own display soon at the Sugar Grove Library. Like Knowledge Enrichment, a lot of the courses are steering towards a more conversational structure, and the classes themselves have become more varied as the organization has grown. Much like you would in college, Henrick and Tattersfield are both taking several classes during this session, everything from literature to travel tips to one titled About Our LGBTQ Family and Friends. Logman says expanding the diversity of classes is a priority.
We want to have all parts of the brain. How can we learn through music? How can we learn through art? How can we learn about different populations? It's so important in the United States now to be aware of all cultures.
They expect the program to keep growing as the U.S. population continues to gray. By the 2030s, older people over 65 are expected to outnumber children under 18 for the first time.
We want to be active. The baby boomers were very active, you know, back in the 60s, and we still have that in us.
That means more people than ever are looking to rewrite the narrative of aging. I'm Peter Medlin.
A lot of towns held municipal elections this week, but in the Southern Illinois community of Marion, they elected a new mayor for the first time in decades. Jennifer Fuller fills us in.
The last time voters in Marion elected a new mayor, Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds had just been released. Bob Butler began his term in office in 1963. He retired just last year. Businessman Mike Absher beat out three others to win election. He's promising revitalization in and around the shuttered Illinois Star Center Mall, along with other economic development projects. Butler outlasted long-serving governors, lawmakers, and is thought to be the longest-serving mayor in Illinois history. He ranks among the top 10 longest-serving in the country. It remains to be seen whether Absher will try to challenge Butler's many years in office. I'm Jennifer Fuller.
We're glad you're with us on Statewide. Illinois might lower the age a child can legally be left home alone. We'll have that story. That's still ahead. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It's easy to find the lowest price for certain items online, but if you're a farmer, it's nearly impossible to compare the costs of seeds or chemicals in your region.
The marketers know everything and we know nothing. We've got no point of reference when we go in to negotiate.
Still ahead, we'll learn more about a Silicon Valley startup that is trying to bring transparency into the agribusiness sector. That's ahead on Statewide. Well, across much of the Midwest, maternal and infant death rates are high, especially among African Americans. So doctors, public health agencies, and nonprofit organizations are searching for solutions. And among them is Sistering CU, located in Champaign-Urbana. It offers free home visits from trained volunteers to families with babies up to 6 months of age. It also recently launched a support group for new parents. The co-founder, Aaron Murphy, spoke with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman about a new initiative to promote safe sleep habits and support families.
We target families who have just had a baby, whether that's through adoption or, you know, had delivered the baby themselves. So our programs focus on sending a volunteer, matching a volunteer to go to their home for 2 hours a week for 12 visits to help them as they recover and transition to becoming a mom and becoming a dad and getting used to having a family life. And it takes help to do that, we believe. So
yeah. You guys have a new grant-funded effort that you are doing right now involving baby boxes. So can you tell me a little bit about what baby boxes are and what purpose they serve?
Yes. So baby boxes are an idea that was developed first in Finland and like in the 1930s. And today, every single family in Finland gets a baby box. And the box, first of all, serves a double purpose. It holds like diapers, bottles, things that that you might need for bringing home a new baby. But the box itself is also a safe place for the baby to sleep.
So like a bassinet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can move it from room to room because it's a box. It's a cardboard box. But inside there is a mattress and some sheets. So it's a comfortable, lightweight, safe place for the baby to go from room to room or to sleep next, you know, like on the floor next to you. And it's shown to reduce rates of SIDS for families that don't have a place that's safe for baby to sleep.
And I learned that even in Virginia, they give these boxes to all new families across the state.
In Virginia, everyone in that whole state will be getting a baby box. And there are some other states like that. New Jersey also, I think, does it. And Louisiana had a program as well. And it has shown in those states to reduce rates of SIDS when they went out.
Yeah, that sudden infant death syndrome.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when we heard about this idea, we were so inspired because it's like both a practical, useful tool for the family and also a symbol of support. Like what you're doing is really important. What it really matters. It's good for the community, for you to be healthy, for your family to be healthy. And so we're just thrilled to be able to start the program. At least, you know, 50 boxes is a small start, but it's a start.
You also recently started a new parent support group.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little about that?
Yes. So we bring one of our volunteers in, and we have a little space for the babies to kind of lay down on the ground, some toys there. So they're right in the room with us. And we just talk about the highs, the lows,
And the in-betweens.
And the in-between, yeah. You know, like, and share tips, like what worked for you for sleeping, what didn't work for you. My baby doesn't sleep. And the truth is some babies just don't sleep. And that's okay, and we can talk about it. And it doesn't mean you're a bad mom or dad that you can't get your baby to take two-hour naps.
Is there anything else you would like to share?
We are recruiting families. I think one of the hardest things is to know that it's normal to need help and to want help at the beginning, and we don't have to do it all on our own. So we're trying to really change the expectations that we can do this, we should do this. In fact, it takes a village, and we have lost our villages around us when we live in a transient community or far away from grandparents or our close friends and neighbors who would have helped us. And we want to be that village. We just want to be there and support you because we do believe what you're doing is really important. We believe you're important. So we just want to be there to support you.
That's Erin Murphy. She's the co-founder of the nonprofit organization Sistering CU, speaking with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman. When is it safe to leave your kids home alone? That's one of the trickiest questions parents face as their children grow up. The right age may depend on the kid and the family. But as Ryan Denham explains, according to state law, the right age is fairly black and white. It's 14.
A bill in Springfield would lower that age to 12, a response to parents who say the current 14-year-old minimum age is unreasonably high. Today, a child under the age of 14 who was left without supervision for, quote, an unreasonable amount of time is considered neglected. Technically, a parent can be charged with child abandonment. They leave a 13-year-old home alone to babysit their 9-year-old sibling. That's State Representative Joe Sosnowski, a Republican from Rockford, who introduced the so-called babysitting bill to lower that home alone age to 12. Sosnowski says Illinois' 14-year-old threshold is higher than all other states with a similar statute. He says only 14 states even specify a certain age, with the most common being 10.
You know, the fact that we don't see a lot of prosecution for that particular point points to the fact that there is, you know, smart local discretion being taken. But again, at a state level, we want to safeguard families from being prosecuted unjustly.
While Bloomington Normal Police aren't exactly sending in SWAT teams to catch parents leaving their teenagers at home after school, several local parents told that the current law makes it harder to arrange child care, causes them needless anxiety, and doesn't reflect their child's maturity. Like many parents, Jessica McDermott of Bloomington is a working mom who cobbles together child care for their soon-to-be 12-year-old and 5-year-old daughters. This summer, the 5-year-old will go to daycare, and some days the older daughter will stay with family in Pontiac. On others, McDermott herself will work from home, so the girl's not alone. McDermott says those summer child care plans would be a whole lot easier if the 12-year-old could just legally stay home alone or watch her sister occasionally. Would also help with the little things like quick trips to the grocery store or to the gym to exercise.
It would be a huge convenience. Like, it would make me feel more assured if I were to choose to leave them. You know, the older one babysitting the younger one, I would not feel like, oh, what if somebody, like, finds out and somebody has a grudge against me and wants to report me or, you know, something like that.
The law is also a bit vague. What does unreasonable amount of time really mean?
Maybe it's okay for me to leave them alone, but I'm not really sure, and I don't want a chance getting in trouble.
Liz Tomera of Normal is a mother of three. She says the rules should reflect that life can be messy. She says she needs the latitude to leave her younger kids alone if, say, she needs to rush out for 15 minutes if her husband's car breaks down on the way home from work.
Sometimes you just don't have a choice. There are plenty of parents who have to go to work all day, and they don't have a choice but to leave the kids home if there's a snow day or whatever. And so I just wish people would be mindful of that, that, you know, the grass isn't always greener on the other side, and your life isn't always going to be the same as someone else's.
Other parents say the law hits them in the pocketbook. Ronelle Hartless of Normal has two daughters, 13 and 9. She works part-time as a recess monitor at a Unit 5 school, so she can be home when the kids get out. She's considered getting a 9-to-5 full-time job elsewhere, but she says it's not worth it because the 13-year-old can't legally watch her little sister. Their family would just have to spend that extra money on after-school care.
When I have a teenager who is perfectly capable of being home after school to take care of my little one, be with my little one, to get her a snack or whatever, and she knows how to cook.
Andrew Locke of Normal has a 15-year-old daughter. He says she knows how to take care of herself. But when his daughter was 9, Locke was charged with misdemeanor child endangerment after she fell down some stairs and injured her knee while he was at work and she was home alone. Locke said a neighbor was supposed to be watching her, but police arrested him and the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services got involved. Locke was eventually found not guilty.
You know, I don't think it's the government's role to teach us or to tell us how we may or may not raise our child. Why should anybody else get involved?
Representative Joe Sosnowski, the bill's sponsor, says Illinois' 14-year-old minimum age came as a legislative overreaction to an infamous 1992 case in which two St. Charles parents left their girls, 9-year-old and 4-year-old, home alone while they spent a week in Mexico. That case drew international attention. So why lower it to 12? Why not 11 or 13?
So that gives us some time to look at it, see how it works. If it is passed into law, you know, we can always continue to take a look at it if we want to adjust it downward still, but you know, at least 12 was a step in the right direction.
The bill, if approved, won't have a huge impact on families in general, according to Dottie Squire with the Child Care Resource Service. They help families find child care in Champaign, Vermilion, Macon, Douglas, Iroquois, and Piatt counties.
Parents who feel like their kids are ready are already staying home.
It's not the age that should determine if it's okay to leave them alone, she says. It's all about how they've been prepared. Do they know when it's okay to open the door for someone? Are there emergency contacts close by, like a neighbor? And do you consider your neighborhood safe? Her service even offers a checklist for parents to go through to make that decision.
It's just a huge numbers of questions that the family needs to ask themselves before they just say, okay, you're going to stay home with your siblings or by yourself.
It's Dottie Squire with the Child Care Resource Service in Urbana. I'm Ryan Denham.
Representative Sosnowski's legislation won near unanimous approval in the House. It now advances to the state Senate. The tech industry in Silicon Valley runs on people's demands for data. The farming industry has lagged behind on this, but it's starting to catch up. Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck looked into one startup that is bringing data together from all over the country in hopes of helping farmers save time and money.
Farmers Business Network is kind of strange. It's funded by some big investors like T. Rowe Price and GV, formerly known as Google Ventures, but it's aimed at helping the little guy. Farmers buy into it for between $500 and $700 a year to share their data. Think seed and fertilizer prices or how well crop varieties did on their farm. In return, they get to see an aggregation of everybody else's information. Farmers like Aaron Phipps say that transparency is important.
The marketers know everything and we know nothing. We've got no point of reference when we go in to negotiate with suppliers to say, hey, this is where the market's at. We had no clue.
Phipps lives in eastern Illinois near the Indiana border. He grows corn and soybeans, and he's one of nearly 8,000 Farmers Business Network members. He used FBN's data to show his local dealer average costs for chemicals like pesticides or fertilizers and asked for something similar.
And oddly enough, that was the first year my chemical bill wasn't 10 to 15% more than I thought it was going to be.
FBN uses its data to find the best types of seed and the best prices for each region. And it says that data reveals how big seed companies were charging more in the heart of farm country, often with the highest rates in central Illinois and northern Indiana. Here's FBN's data science head, Matt Meisner.
You know, we expected there'd be differences. I think we were surprised at the magnitude and the impact that it has on growers.
Because the prices are inflated for such large areas, FBN blames companies at the very top, like Syngenta or Bayer, which merged with Monsanto last year. Harvest Public Media couldn't independently confirm FBN's findings, which said it didn't want to expose member information. We also contacted the seed companies FBN blames for price differences. Bayer didn't respond directly to questions about that, instead highlighting the technical assistance and research it provides beyond seeds and chemicals. Other seed companies pointed to the American Seed Trade Association to speak on their behalf. That association lobbies and advocates for a lot of seed companies, including, as it turns out, Farmers Business Network. Andy Levine is president and CEO of the Trade Association. He says he hasn't seen the Farmers Business Network data, but notes prices vary a lot due to when farmers buy seed or how much they buy. And he says company guarantees and trustworthiness mean something.
That seed company is evaluated by that farmer every single harvest. And if they're not delivering, that farmer's going to go somewhere else. And so there's good relationships out there for generations.
Levine says price transparency is good for farmers in the ag industry, and seed companies know it's something farmers may demand.
And I think seed companies will be ready to have that conversation. You know, as I've talked to them, and they realize that as farmers are getting additional information, I guess I don't see this as that unusual of a situation.
Farmers Business Network also had to build up trust. It even sells its own seed now, which could make some question their claims about other seed companies. But farmer Aaron Phipps said FBN's data has been solid since before they got into sales, and he still stands behind it.
I still trust the information I'm getting from them in terms of average prices and stuff, and I don't have to purchase things from them.
Phipps' main fear is that Farmers Business Network gets bought up by one of the big seed companies. But even then,
I think now that we've seen what can be done, I think the genie is out of the bottle, and you can't stuff this toothpaste back in the tube.
Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
That wraps up another edition of Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again this time next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find all of our episodes at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available through NPR One. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.